Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collected works of Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I am Annie A.K.
And I'm Jessie.
And today we are talking about chapters 20 through 25, or 21 through 25, of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility. We are almost done, but not really halfway. We're halfway.
I mean, that's like a pretty big milestone. I definitely think we should make sure that we embrace it somehow or celebrate it somehow.
Absolutely. We're like reaching the peak of the hill, and then surely it is all downhill from here.
I know. Well, a lot happened, right? I mean, we'll get into it, but like, whoa.
So much happened in just five chapters. I mean, up until now, we've been saying, wow, these are really dense chapters for how short they are, how simply they're written. But man, things have happened. But before we get into that, Jessie, what have you been up to lately in the world of books and TV and film?
Well, thank you for asking. I just finished reading How to Build a Girl by Catlin Moran. And it's a coming of age story of a young woman growing up poor in a small town in England. And she's a gifted writer and ends up writing for a music magazine and spending her days on the scene with rock and roll bands and rock stars. And it's so funny. I was in a public place a couple times and like cried laughing. And it's going to be a movie with Beanie Feldstein. And Annie has already read it and was very helpful during my reading process as I came to terms with certain parts of it.
I was big on the peer pressure. The same thing happened to me when I started reading it. It was like New Year's Day. I was at a friend's house having just like spent New Year's Eve at hers. And we were just reading, you know, on the sofa with the sun streaming in. And she kept going, please stop. I can hear you just giggling every 5 minutes and you need to stop.
Oh, it's so funny. I don't think I've ever cried laughing from a book before, but I definitely did a few times while reading this. And I'm really excited to read the sequel, How to Be Famous with Annie, when she gets around to it.
I've been following Catlin Moran's writing off and on for a couple years, so I'm really excited that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, it was great, and I definitely recommend it. And I have also been doing a rewatch of Downton Abbey before the movie comes out. I think by the time this airs, I'll have seen the movie already, and I'll hopefully have been done with my rewatch, because I just started season six today. But it's been really fun, and it's also been fun to watch in tandem with our read of Sense and Sensibility and our deep dive into Austen. I know that the time periods are very different, but it's still kind of the same, you know, like a woman can't be left alone with a man and the courting rules and things like that. And it kind of still gives me Jane Austen vibes, right? You know, like Mary doesn't like Matthew, even though she's supposed to, and she has to get married, or the inheritance of the Abbey will disappear, you know, stuff like that. And it's been kind of a fun compliment to our reading here.
It's kind of amazing how these rules of decorum and marital status and inheritance kind of have been preserved with the aristocracy class. Is that the right phrase?
Yeah, aristocratic class.
From Jane Austen's time to the early 20th century.
Yeah, no, it's been really fun to watch and read together, and I'm very excited for the movie, so I hope it's good.
Yeah, one fun difference between like the upstairs, downstairs, Downton Abbey kind of thing and the Jane Austen stuff is the fact that they acknowledge that there is a serving class in Downton Abbey. And I think we've gotten maybe two mentions in all of Sense and Sensibility so far that anyone had people taking care of them at all. But they're there somewhere.
That's a really good point. I feel like a lot of the characters we've met so far in Sense and Sensibility have been middle class or upper middle class. And they've all had a few servants, but it's definitely not the same upstairs, downstairs vibe that you get with Downton Abbey. That's just a whole other level. Maybe when we move on to Pride and Prejudice.
I wonder if somewhere you can find someone has written like the other side of the Austen books, all the servants and their going ons.
That sounds like a really good idea. Maybe we'll pocket that for later.
All right. Don't tell anyone our brilliant idea.
You hear that, listeners? Don't tell anyone. So what are you consuming lately, media-wise, Annie?
So I finally finished The Other Einstein, the sort of historical fiction by Marie Benedict about Mileva Marich Einstein. It was fine in the end. I really enjoyed the first half of the book. The second half, it just became a bit of a slog. A lot of it was really repetitive. I grew really frustrated in that way where you know, if you had a girlfriend and she was stuck in this horrible, awful, unhappy relationship and had some somewhat understandable reasons for staying, but you keep going, you have to go. And then she keeps staying with him. It was a lot of that feeling. So that was frustrating. Plus, it was a really one-dimensional, I think, characterization of Maleva, who is this like perfect put-upon angel. And Einstein, who was just trash, 100% abusive, horrible, narcissistic trash, which I think, you know, we've seen in other portrayals and in history in general, that he was a fairly complex guy, also trash, but not just trash. It was kind of disappointing in the end. I found the resolution to be fairly anticlimactic because of it, and just kind of a whimper of an end. I've been told by others who've listened to the audiobook that it's even more stark, just this complete, I don't want to call it defamation of character, but it was pretty close to that about Einstein, who admittedly does not need more defenders, but a more complex picture would have made it more interesting as a reader. I will highly recommend the National Geographic series called Genius. The first season is about Einstein. At some points, you're definitely not on his side, but it's a much fuller, more complex, more varied portrayal of him and of Maleva and of his the woman that he ended up marrying after Maleva and he get divorced, who in the book does just seem like a complete conniving harlot. So there's that. Season two is also fine, but it's literally the exact same story, but everyone has Spanish accents. I did start rereading How to Build a Girl as well, so I've been really excited about that. And then we're going to do the sequel together, as you said.
As if we're not in enough book clubs.
No. How many is it now?
It's like five or something.
That doesn't sound like enough. And I really love Catelyn Moran's writings. And I started watching Sanditon. I think it's going to be...
Some reason I read it in my head is Sandition.
I know that too. So that's been fun. I think the episodes are going to air on PBS in January. It's been really fun. I don't know too much about the story overall or how much that Jane Austen actually wrote before her passing. I believe like the general sketch of the story and various characters were already sketched out, but I'm enjoying it so far. A little too sexy at times, but I thought it was really interesting to discover that the one character whose name Georgiana or Georgia, maybe Georgiana, was played by a Black British actress was a character that Jane Austen actually did write. So that's been really cool.
Oh yeah, I'll have to check that out.
It's been a long like 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
No, I am definitely interested to hear what you have to say about it, because the discussions about her place as a mixed race character in this time period and her more than humble beginnings, as I think I can call it, are really interesting.
Oh yeah, I'm super curious.
But of course, as all things do, things come back to Jane Austen.
No, it's a good transition. I believe that you did the chapter summary the last time. Mm-hmm. So you want to tell us what we previously missed on Sense and Sensibility?
Sure. Previously on Sense and Sensibility, we took a break from Marianne's romantic troubles to focus on Eleanor, whose beau Edward has come to visit. Rather than being delighted to be reunited with the object of his affections, Edward is reserved to Eleanor, even though Marianne notices him wearing a locked ring containing a lock of hair that is thought to be Eleanor's. Edward stays pretty grumpy and eventually leaves them to be replaced by the Palmers, a couple that Eleanor finds pretty mismatched in temperament. We left the Dashwood sisters still unlucky in love, but handling their misfortunes in different ways. Marianne still determinedly in love and outwardly pining versus Eleanor's internal emotional pain.
Poor Eleanor and Marianne. Our sisters are kind of bummed out right now.
They are. There's not a lot of happiness going on at Barton Cottage.
There's not much to be had in these chapters either. Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
So, in the chapters that we read for today's episode, we said goodbye to the Palmers, but we get new additions to the story as our favorite host, Sir John Middleton, invites Anne and Lucy Steele, two young ladies from Exeter, to come and visit at Barton. Sir John wants everyone to get along and praises each pair of the other sisters to the other, but when they actually meet, Eleanor and Marianne are annoyed by the way the Steele sisters indulge Lady Middleton's spoiled children and discuss where all the best men, young men can be found. Eleanor finds Lucy clever but uneducated, but the Steele sisters are nonetheless fond of the Dashwoods, and Lucy just keeps on trying to get Eleanor to like her. Sir John, unable to keep a secret, mentions the name of Edward Ferrars to tease Eleanor. Upon hearing the name, Lucy is all of a sudden very interested in if Eleanor has ever met Mrs. Ferrars, and then reveals that she has been secretly engaged to Edward for 4 years. Let me just take a pause here for everyone to gasp at this reveal. Because Edward was a pupil of Lucy's uncle, and that's where their relationship began. According to Lucy, they had to conceal their engagement because Lucy has no fortune, but it's her lock of hair that Edward has in his ring. This confession leaves Eleanor sick with grief and in disbelief. Eleanor reflects on Lucy's news and reasons that her engagement to Edward must have been the product of youthful infatuation, and she's certain that Edward could not possibly still love Lucy after all these years of getting to know what such a frivolous and ignorant woman. She also chooses not to share the news with her mother and sister. She and Lucy converse at length about Edward during a dinner party while everyone is distracted, and Lucy confesses to Eleanor that she's a very jealous woman, but she obviously has no reason at all to suspect Edward's unfaithfulness. And she states that it'd be madness for her and Edward to marry because he only has 2,000 pounds, so they have to wait for him to inherit his mother's fortune. Eleanor then keeps mentioning her secret engagement to Eleanor, despite Eleanor not wanting to hear about it anymore. Mrs. Jennings then invites the Dashwood girls to join her at her home in London, and at first the girls decline because they don't want to leave their mother, but Mrs. Dashwood assures them that she won't be alone. She has Margaret. Remember Margaret? Marianne is overjoyed that she'll get to see Willoughby, but Eleanor is apprehensive about the journey because she does not want to find herself in the company of both Lucy and Edward together.
That is quite a lot of stuff that happens.
That is. I feel like we were destined for dinner parties where lots of gossip happens, but nothing actually happens. But no, here we are in the middle of the book, and we get a big, big drop of information.
Yeah, and a lot of, like, really suspicious activity going on.
But so we should just jump into it. Like, what do you think about this big development? What do you think about Lucy's secret?
I mean, I can't say I'm hugely surprised that whatever Edward was hiding was this level of, like, big and crazy and, oh no, you didn't. Because obviously he was hiding something and he had to, like, leave suddenly, or he was acting super weird with Eleanor when the Dashwoods first had to leave. So when, you know, Austin introduces these two ladies and one of them just happens to go, oh yeah, that guy. I'm, like, super going to marry.
Oh, yeah.
It's less surprising and more like, I just want to punch her in the face. Is that wrong of me?
I don't know. I know we are trying to look kind of at everyone we meet and get all different perspectives. But, yeah, Lucy is... Well, she's not Eleanor, right?
No,
so we've been rooting for Eleanor this whole time. So... of course, we're going to view someone that comes in and says that she's engaged to this man that we know that Eleanor loves. So, yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of Lucy.
Is Jessamyr the Steeles kind of like Bizarro Dashwood sisters?
Oh, I love that. I love the description of them. They found in the appearance of the eldest, who is nearly 30, oh my gosh, with a very plain and not a sensible face, nothing to admire. But in the other, who was no more than 2 or 3 and 20, they acknowledged considerable beauty. Her features were pretty, and she had a quick eye and a smartness of air, which, though it did not give actual elegance or grace, gave distinction to her person.
They're very dismissive of Anne. I guess you could probably think that she's like, oh, she's the smart, contained, internal one, to Lucy's, like, more vivacious, outward going, more romantic side. But they're also, like, super annoying.
Yeah, so the way that the Steeles ingratiate themselves in the story, right, is they suck up to the children. The Steeles children, they're, like, all about the kids. Fortunately for those who pay their court through such foibles, a fond mother, though in pursuit of praise for her children, the most rapacious of human beings, is likewise the most credulous. Her demands are exorbitant, but she will swallow anything, and the excessive affection and endurance of the Miss Steeles towards her offspring were viewed therefore by Lady Middleton without the smallest surprise or distrust. And so Jane's basically saying, in order to get in good with someone, suck up to their children.
Yeah, and I mean, it's working. Is the problem. It's actually working.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, just to take, like, an aside, I did appreciate that Lady Middleton clearly at least has some joy in her life. She finds some life in her kids, but it also just makes her vulnerable to this, not quite manipulation that the Steels are doing, but it is super extra the way they're just falling over these kids. And what's it when the little girl like gets scratched in the pin or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they just spend the whole time just trying to make her happy. And the kid is just like, man, this is getting me a lot of attention. I'm just going to keep going for a bit.
Yes, I love the line. It's with such a reward for her tears, the child was too wise to cease crying.
That is a smart little girl.
No, I don't get the sense that it's malicious, that they mm-hmm. are trying to like get in on it. I do think they're trying to be friendly. And I think that the Steels like the Dashwood sisters. Mm-hmm. And it's just that Eleanor and Marion are kind of maybe a little snobbish here and not wanting to. I mean, it doesn't sound like Lucy or her sister are that great necessarily, but there is an element there of Eleanor thinking that they're a little too good to be conversing with them.
Yeah, and it's not even like a typical society kind of snobbishness. It's just very, I mean, first of all, it's Sir John who is just building them up the whole time going, no, they're like the sweetest girls to ever exist. They're so great. You're going to love them. I love them. You're going to love them. So that's setting up like an unfair expectation where if it was coming from Sir John, I too would be incredibly wary.
That's true.
Yeah, and then once they actually get there, they kind of live up to it, but in a way that seems almost forced and not super earnest. It's too much. But maybe I'm just a snob too.
No, I mean, there's a quote at the beginning of chapter 22 where it says, Lucy was naturally clever. Her remarks were often just and amusing. And as a companion for half an hour, Eleanor frequently found her agreeable. But her powers had received no aid from education. She was ignorant and illiterate, and her deficiency of all mental improvement, her want of information in the most common particulars, could not be concealed from Miss Dashwood, in spite of her constant endeavor to appear to her advantage. She says, you know, like, Lucy's fine for half an hour, but for them to just sit there and listen to them, I guess it's her ignorance and being illiterate probably, you know, really read the wrong way.
Yeah, and probably there's something in not seeming like she wanted to pursue more knowledge and improve upon herself. That's the kind of thing that Eleanor is picking up on and thinking, that's not that great. You are not that great. There's room for improvement. You should be aware of it. And because of that, I'm not that interested.
Yeah, you know, I was looking online, and when they say lack of education, they're not talking about, you know, like, oh, they didn't go to college. Mm-hmm. Like, when they're saying they lack education, they're talking about how women in this time studied things like drawing and painting and piano, and women of these certain classes were expected to acquire certain skills or accomplishments. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, we see that Eleanor's accomplished in drawing and Marianne's an accomplished pianist, but the Steels don't have those kind of skills to recommend them. And so the purpose of these accomplishments is to help them get a husband, right? Like it's not going to school, but we also specifically hear that Lucy is illiterate, so she can't even read or write. So there's no hope really for her of getting these accomplishments, even if Lucy is admittedly pretty and quick-witted enough to sustain a conversation with Eleanor for half an hour.
And we know from Jane Austen, you know, she had like a little bit of a formal education, but a lot of it was she was an autodidact. She taught herself a lot of things, as well as had that sort of education and pursuit of knowledge enforced in the household, with especially from her father. So she holds it in very high regard, and it's coming through here in the page. And it does seem unfair to hold that against Lucy. It is it's a privilege that not everyone had, especially in that time period, and some people still don't now. So
that's true.
It does seem like unfair to hold it against her. But again, I find Lucy annoying, so I hold it against her.
Yeah, I mean, it would be one thing if in the novel all of her problems about Lucy stemmed to the fact that she was annoying and pretended to be smarter mm-hmm. than she was, but the problems don't, right? The problems start when we find out that, no, she's engaged to the man that Eleanor loves.
So one part about Lucy's engagement and how she could not stop talking about it to Eleanor was whether or not, because they mention at some point that Sir John brings it up that Eleanor has a beau, his name starts with an F, okay, the F stands for Ferrers. Is she just like, I'm having a hard time understanding if she just if it didn't sink in that this is who Eleanor was interested in, or if she was just being very cruel talking about it to Eleanor the whole time.
I do think there's an element of cruelty in it, in bringing it up. I think they're slightly fishing a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they showed up knowing that Eleanor was someone that Edward was interested in. I do think they wanted to be friendly. Mm-hmm. And it is when John brings it up and he's like, oh, like Eleanor likes someone whose name also starts with an E or whatever, that they put the pieces together. And Lucy's very quick to kind of just like shut it down. I think that's what she's trying to do.
Yeah, because as we've established, she is very clever and probably very sharp. And it just seemed like really weird to me the way she almost acted like she didn't know when she was bringing it up to Eleanor, because she's like, listen, I just feel really close to you and I want to tell you a secret. And the secret is I'm in love with this guy. Don't mind the fact that I think I know that you are also in love with him, but like I'm in love with him and he's in love with me.
You know what this kind of reminded me of? You mm-hmm. know in Mean Girls when Regina finds out that Caddy likes Aaron Samuels and she goes like, I can help you, you know, like to see if he likes you. And they play that like elaborate thing and basically she claims Aaron Samuels just so Caddy can't have him.
Yes. And she's like pushing his hair back in front of Katie and being like, don't you think he's so much sexier with his hair back like this?
Yes. It's such like girl drama too. At one point she says to Eleanor like, oh, Edward loves your family. He looks at you guys just like his own sisters. Like, can you imagine a greater, like a more passive aggressive like burn? Like, oh, he looks at you like you're his sister.
Yeah. No. So like part of me is just like, maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe Jane Austen is purposely creating just like different types of female characters. And that is something that should be embraced and enjoyed for all its complexity and variety. But it's like, no, she's actually, maybe it's because everyone is so polite about it, but it's hard to ignore the fact that she's kind of awful then.
No, I think, you know, for all that we talk about the fact that Lucy, you know, isn't accomplished, she's not educated, she's illiterate, blah, 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 she's obviously mm-hmm. sharp and she can pick up on things. And we're supposed to get that right off the bat, even before we know that she was engaged or is engaged to Edward. So we know that she's smart enough to pick up on these things, on social cues. You know, at first we're kind of willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. You know, she presses it a little bit, but then towards the end of the chapters that we read, she really does like literally rub it in into Eleanor. So I think by that point we're supposed to I don't think we're supposed to hate Lucy, but we're definitely supposed to not like her or not find her as suitable of a mate for Edward as Eleanor is.
The difference between the two of them are so stark, because Lucy is, even more so than Marianne, is fixated on romance and everything. Lucy is very fixated on like, who's going to marry who? Do you have a boyfriend? Do you have a boyfriend? What's your boyfriend like? Tell me about your boyfriend. Who this guy you're going to marry? Congratulations on like nabbing this amazing beau to be your fiance. Then you've got Eleanor in comparison, who, you know, is probably pretty sure that Lucy knows about her connection with Edward, being so polite and allowing herself to be a confidant, because I mean, I'm sure that Lucy hasn't been able to tell too many people, but the way she keeps spouting it out, I'm not 100% sure that more people don't know. And she even doesn't want to be this person who's like, she doesn't want to give her advice that will somehow benefit herself. She's just like, I recuse myself from this conversation, but if you want to talk about it and vent about something that's obviously that weighs a lot on you, go for it.
No, I think it's very mean, actually, the way that Lucy says to Eleanor straight up, you know, like, oh, I value your opinion so much. Like, tell me what I should do. Do you think I should break up with him? Like, there she's actually goading Eleanor into trying to pick a fight. And I think she does that a few times. Like, I think it's chapter 24. I think the exact wording of the quote is, and yet I do assure you, replied Lucy, her little sharp eyes full of meaning. There seemed to be a coldness and displeasure in your manner that made me quite uncomfortable. Like, she's bringing it up again to Eleanor and she's goading her like, oh, like you seemed kind of like awkward, you seemed uncomfortable, like why is that? So Lucy knows what she's doing, and we know that she knows what she's doing. But, and here's where I'm about to give her some benefit of the doubt, other than just being kind of a mean girl, I think she's jealous of Eleanor.
I could see that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can see that, because one assumes Edward has mentioned the Dashwoods to her. It sounds like she has, and has mentioned his affection towards them.
Well, Eleanor even says, right after she finds out that Lucy was disposed to be jealous of her, appeared very probable. And so I really want to talk to you about this part, because Eleanor thinks about it for a while, because she's devastated when she hears about it, and she thinks about it for a while. And her conclusions aren't, okay, whatever, like, Edward and Lucy are in love, like, I'm going to bow out. Her conclusions are that Lucy's jealous of her, and that there's no way a man like Edward could possibly still be in love with a woman like Lucy 4 years after their engagement, and it must have been like a youthful dalliance.
So that's completely the sort of thing that you tell yourself to make yourself feel sane, first of all. That's just because, I mean, just like Marianne and Mrs. Dashwood were doing with Willoughby, they just kind of create these stories where it's not, well, he was actually just really cruel and dismissed me when I was putting my heart and soul into this. But I don't think Eleanor is completely being petty about it and just making up the story for herself to feel better, because she's right. I mean, they have this relationship for so long, and if she and Edward are of similar temperament and Eleanor finds her annoying, one would think that Edward might also too, or at least that's something she could tell herself.
No, that's true. I mean, she said, could he, were his affection for her out of the question, with his integrity, his delicacy, and well-informed mind, be satisfied with a wife like her, illiterate, artful, and selfish? You know, these are Eleanor's thoughts, and they're meaner than maybe the objective truth, but everything we've learned about Eleanor so far is that she really compartmentalizes everything, that she grieves quietly, that she's not over-emotional, that she's very, for lack of a better word, sensible. So maybe we're supposed to read this at face value. Like, Edward was upset, not because he had left Lucy to be with Eleanor, but because he had made this promise to Lucy and doesn't want to break it. So I think I see both sides, but Eleanor might be a unreliable narrator.
Probably. And we've seen in the past that she and Marianne aren't as different as they like to think that they are, especially Eleanor. So this creating the fantasy or this story to make herself feel better, that's definitely something Marianne would do. So you could also see Eleanor kind of heading in that direction as well. Whenever things of the heart get involved, she is definitely less rational than she tries to portray herself as the rest of the time. So I can definitely see it. But I mean, it is hard to give Edward that much credit when all this time he has never literally said anything even to Eleanor, or at least given some sign that, like, this is great, but it also can't happen for a reason. Either my heart is, you know, belongs to someone else, or I've already promised myself to someone else.
No, that's a really good point, because we've only really seen Edward through other people's eyes in terms of hearing about his affection for Eleanor. And then when we finally do meet Edward, it's not like he's all over Eleanor. He's depressed and anxious. And I mean, I think we talked about last episode that Edward says that he's awkward and things like that, but he clearly is a little bit different than when Eleanor first was with him. And I think that could be easily explained with him being upset that he had to leave his beloved that he can't be with right now because he can't afford it. But it also makes sense that he's upset because he went to visit Lucy and realized that he no longer loves her, but he had made a promise to her.
At least with Willoughby, he said, well, this was nice. I'm so sorry. It can't happen. I'm going to go now. Please don't change.
Oh my God, I'd forgotten about Willoughby.
I wish I could. Marianne keeps bringing him up.
I know. I feel...
He's never far from her mind in the choices that she makes, even when she's trying to... when she's actually there for her sister and commiserating for Eleanor, it's still kind of like, oh, but maybe if Willoughby were in this situation, we would be able to find a way to be with each other. Or later on, when Mrs. Jennings invites them into town with them, and Eleanor goes, oh, she just wants to be near Willoughby, doesn't she? He's never really gone, even though we don't talk about him.
No, that's true. But why do you think that Eleanor didn't tell her sister? Like, I understand maybe, like, not wanting to tell her mom, but why wouldn't she tell Marianne about Lucy, what Lucy said about her being engaged? I know she says to the reader, like, oh, I promise I'd keep it a secret, but, like, that's not a good enough reason to me. Like, do you think that she just doesn't want to have to deal with, like, Marianne feeling bad for her? Or Marianne might be jealous that someone else is in pain? You know, I don't know.
That's a good question. There are probably a lot of reasons. I'm sure that Marianne would really empathize with her sister if she knew about it, and she would try to be there and comfort her. Maybe not in the ways that Eleanor needs someone to comfort her, or wants to be comforted and maybe needs. So it might be that, but it could also just be a pride thing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, she's the one in the family with all the sense. She's the one who takes care of them and makes sure that they make the right choices and don't get too involved with someone when their heart may get hurt. Any of it. So to be the one who fell for the wrong guy, only to be kind of embarrassed like this, that may be something that she's really afraid of.
Oh, you think that she's embarrassed to be hurt, to have put her heart on the line and then have it kind of be crushed versus Marianne, who wants everybody to know?
I think so. I think it's one of those things where, maybe I'm projecting, but it maybe it's one of those things where she's used to living in this one role and she takes a lot of pride in being that person and being the one who takes care of the family. And if she wasn't able to take care of herself, it kind of messes with how she sees herself. And then how is anyone meant to depend on her if she can't even get her own shit together?
Oh, I like that. I hadn't really thought of it, but I think that's really it here. Like, she'd rather suffer in silence. And she does suffer because all this reveal like happens pretty early in these chapters that we set out to read. And the subsequent chapters are really just Eleanor suffering in silence. Like, some of the stuff that she has to endure, like, she's like in heartbreak. Like, we know how devastated she is and she has to pretend she's not. Meanwhile, she has to deal with Lucy going on and on about Edward's love for me has been put to the test by our long absence and separation, and we've stood trial, and he's never given me a moment's alarm. And then she has to deal with Mr. Middleton, you know, going on and on about, you know, Edward. Like, it's just like she really kind of goes through the ringer here, and she does it all in silence without her family to confide in.
So I just want to ask, it sounds like you are really sympathizing with Eleanor right now, and rightly so. She's going through some stuff right now, and it's such a huge, like, you know, coming from the side out of nowhere. What's the word? Side tackle? Is that a word? I don't know sports. But do you at any point just get frustrated with her in these parts?
That's a really good question. I do really empathize with her. And again, maybe that is just me projecting also. You know, I feel like how many people have, you know, been in really liked someone and found that they couldn't have them or that they liked someone else. And I feel like those feelings are pretty universal. So it's understandable that any reader mm-hmm. would probably project onto that. But I disagree with Eleanor's decision not to tell her sister and to kind of maybe suffer all that in silence. There is kind of a sort of a martyr aspect to that. You know, like, she's sitting there thinking, like, she's taking solace. The only way she can take solace is in the knowledge that she's better than Lucy and that she is more deserving of Edward. And with that knowledge, she's able to sit there and sort of endure all of the things that Lucy and everyone around her is saying. So I don't think that's really the healthy way to handle it. You know, like, nowadays, right, like, Eleanor would call up Edward and be like, hey, what the hell, you've been engaged to this one, you know, so, but like, what, she's going to write him a letter, you know, like, it's like her options are a little bit different than maybe yours or I would be in the same situation nowadays. But I do think she should have told Marianne. I think it would have helped to confide in someone rather than sit there and endure all of that in silence. So I don't know if I was annoyed, but I don't fully understand some of her decisions, and I do understand the need to talk yourself up here, but I do think it's sort of unfair to, like, Edward could never love Lucy. It's like, well, on the face of it, mm-hmm. every sign is pointing that he does love Lucy. He loves Lucy. I know. So were you annoyed with Eleanor?
I don't know if annoyed is a word, but and part of it might just be bleed over from reading the other Einstein, where you have this woman who, thanks to these expectations and norms dictated by society in their time, and that, you know, we still feel the ramifications these days, is stuck in a situation where they don't have a lot of power and a lot of, like, viable options to pursue. And if they do pursue them, it requires a lot of self-sacrifice. But like you said, it's really hard for me to understand why she doesn't tell Marianne. Like, maybe in the past she's told Marianne to not be that person, so it might be really hard for her to be that person. But I And I know it is a natural instinct to, and I totally relate to it, to portray Lucy as this terrible, really annoying person that Edward just has to kind of tolerate. When Edward is certainly playing his part in this situation as well, she does not direct any frustration or resentment towards him, mm-hmm. which is interesting.
Good point. Good point.
But I mean, I don't want to sympathize for Lucy either. But the more we talk about it, the more I find myself going, well, she's like Marianne and Eleanor, more like Marianne, because someone who's just like really romantic and really caught up in the game that all women are supposed to be caught up with in that time, which is getting married. This was her chance to like get out of her family, to get married, to have a sustainable life. And on top of that, someone she actually seems to care for, whether it's the idea of Edward or actually Edward himself, because I don't see how they have anything in common. And this other woman is here that she may or may not know about, and she's a threat to that certainty in her life. On top of Edward's mother, who's no one likes. So far, no one likes her whatsoever. Everyone seems to agree across the board. Not a big fan of Mrs. Ferrars. But I mean, you kind of can't blame her for, you know, planting her flag, asserting her dominance, and playing that very polite game that they all have to play, where no one really hates each other, but they all quietly hate each other.
I think you've actually managed to convince me to sympathize with Lucy. Any congratulations.
I feel dirty.
You should feel super proud of yourself.
I don't. I feel really gross.
No, I think you're right. I think we can separate this, our feelings about Lucy, into kind of two categories. I don't think it's fair to do what Eleanor does and mm-hmm. judge her for being illiterate. You know, that's not her fault. You know, here we are in this period of time where women's accomplishments are measured and how well they play the piano and things like that, which is fine. I don't want to judge that either. But I don't think we can say that she's not good enough because she can't read or wasn't educated in a way that we would consider sufficient, or that Eleanor would consider sufficient. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. I think we need to separate that out. That's not a fair critique of Lucy. I also understand the impulse to stake, like as you said, and make it clear to Eleanor, like, Edward's mine. We are engaged. And all signs, literally all the signs indicate that, yes, Edward is engaged to Lucy. He was wearing the ring. You know, we know that it's not Eleanor's hair, and that makes sense. Who else would know about the secret ring that he wears with the lock of hair? So all signs do point to their being legitimately engaged. But I do think we can get annoyed with Lucy for being so obnoxious to Eleanor about it. And also her sister, because isn't there that like her sister Anne, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't get a lot of lines, but she gets this one line where she says, "I dare say Lucy's beau is quite as modest and pretty well-behaved as Miss Dashwood's."
I super slept on that line, and I'm like, oh, snap, girl, you have quietly came in with that dagger like an assassin.
Yeah, right? That's like, it like physically hurt me. So, yeah, I think all this time I kind of been sounding like a broken record, because I've been going on and on. Like, Eleanor's our conduit to Jane. Like, what Eleanor mm-hmm. believes is what Jane believes. And I think in this situation is our first, for at least my real test, where it's Eleanor is an unreliable narrator. I don't think a lot of what she's saying is fair. But yeah, girl, you got your feelings hurt by Lucy. Like, feel bad about it. I would.
I think a lot of criticism against Jane Austen's writing tends to fall along the lines of like, oh, her heroines are always so perfect. They never do anything wrong. They never do anything wrong. They never do anything. It's too buttoned up. There's no real emotion. It's so cold. But even within that structure, and with Jane Austen not being a very sensible, emotional person herself, I think she's doing a really good job here revealing this flawed character, this very human character, where, you know, her pride's been wounded, her heart's been broken. She's trying to play the part that she's meant to play as a woman in her time, and this especially a woman of intelligence who should know better than letting her emotions take over. I think she's like doing a really great job of letting us see that side of Eleanor that Eleanor probably tries really, really hard to hide even from herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very sexy.
No, it is very sexy. Thank you. No, it is. I wouldn't call Lucy the villain here, because mm-hmm. I do think you're right. We have met, like, Mrs. Ferrars is not, we haven't really met her yet, but clearly she's not the best person in the world. But in terms of outright villains, I don't think I would consider Lucy one, because she really hasn't done anything villainy. It's not like she knew that Eleanor was in love with Edward and stole him out from under her or anything like nefarious like that, other than maybe twisting the knife a little bit.
Yeah. If anything, she got there first, it seems.
Yeah, they've been engaged for, what, 4 years?
And
so
they knew each other for a long time before then.
Yeah, so if we have a villain in the story, I don't really think we do, to be quite honest with you. But we do have...
The patriarchy.
The patriarchy is
the villain. Is the patriarch.
But we do have, what are they called? Like obstacles in the hero's journey.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Part of it is, I will say it, might be Edward's, like, personal social anxiety.
Yeah, right?
It's like, oh, this is an awkward situation. I should tell them both that I'm in love with one person, I was in love with another person, and am now and have been engaged with them for so long. I should address this and make sure everything is clear, but I could also
be a moody not. Little
yeah, just be moody and not talk about my feelings, because that's not a thing that's done.
You made that point earlier, and you made it again here, and I think it's a really good one, because you're right, Edward, dude, like, you gotta communicate. You can't just be grumpy and mess with people's emotions like that. Edward deserves some blame here, and I'm fine giving it to him.
Yeah, he seems to be skating by in Eleanor's eyes about his role in this whole debacle.
But yeah, I am curious if we, you know, in the next few chapters when they do go to London, what Edward's going to say when he does see Eleanor and Lucy together.
I mean, if we see them. Things always happen in London. It's a big city.
That's true, although we keep meeting people that know everybody, so it doesn't seem that big.
That is interesting. And I mean, there is a potential of seeing Willoughby again, if not by pure happenstance, then by Marianne's machinations.
Yeah. We would definitely see Willoughby again, I'm sure. In my edition of the book, and I think it's every edition of the book, it's split into part one and part two. And I'm kind of curious your thoughts about why, maybe not necessarily why Jane Austen split the book up into parts one and two, but why does she choose to do it the way she does? Part one of the novel ends with Eleanor's disappointment and astonishment upon hearing about Lucy's secret engagement to Edward. And it directly links the next chapter. It's not like it's like 1 year later or like 3 months later. Like, it literally continues on into chapter 23, but she deliberately interrupts the plot at this point to focus on her central character. And this is a really big turning point in the whole book, you know, this revelation. And it's a pretty big development in the story.
Very interesting. So I have the Kindle version, which is the version I've been reading. And I don't actually have that.
Oh, really? Oh, that's so interesting.
It's between, you said 22 and 23 is where it got split into the next part?
Yeah.
That is very interesting indeed. I wonder if it is this publishing thing or if that's how she really wrote it. I wonder if that's around the time where we do see more of like the emotional side of things and things... As the truth is being revealed. Maybe this is now the time where we're going to see everything being revealed that's been going on behind the curtain that we haven't fully been aware of. Because, you know, we've got a lot of secrets happening, especially from the potential suitors. But, I mean, we also have Eleanor hiding stuff from her family as well.
I think that, you know, here is where we get this really big turning point. You know, the 22nd chapter ends with Eleanor finding out and her being devastated. So now that she had pretty slim hopes, to be completely frank, based on what we read so far, of marrying Edward, you know, it didn't sound like it was going to happen. They weren't obviously engaged, and he had seemed kind of weird when they met. But here's where it's all kind of like over for her, and she's really depressed, and that's where it kind of leaves us. But in the next chapter, chapter 23, it immediately picks up with Eleanor kind of having all of her hopes dashed in this big point in the plot, and then her kind of deciding, like, no, like, there's no way this is happening. Like, it's kind of like the falling action and then rising action.
So do you think it's just that all the things that we have been seeing up until now, all the groundwork that Jane Austen had been laying down is finally going to be paying off here.
Yeah, I think so. I think we know we have at least most of the cards on the table, but then I guess we don't, right? Because we don't know the deal with Colonel Brandon. We don't know the deal with Willoughby. So I don't really know. I think the only justification I really have is, okay, it ends on the down beat, but now we kind of, we see Eleanor thinking and strategizing and wanting to take action, so to speak.
I am definitely interested in seeing Eleanor taking more action rather than a lot of rationalizing, quite frankly. So, so much rationalizing to the point where her calm, rational side is actually kind of a detriment, I think, to her and to her dealing with whatever the hell is happening.
That's a really good point.
I'm really interested to see what's going to happen now.
I know. Now,
how part two is going to be different than part one.
Yeah, right? No. So Annie, I have some candidates for these chapters' biggest and greatest Austen burn.
Right. I'm going to have to find where I put all of mine. There were a few that I meant to put down and I just kept forgetting.
I know. Most of mine are weirdly in the first chapter, in chapter 21.
I did have one in from 25, though. Mostly because I just wanted to give that one to Miss Dashwood. Let me see if I can find one.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So for Mrs. Dashwood, when they're discussing the two sisters, the two older sisters, because I keep forgetting Margaret, the two of them going to London with Mrs. Jennings as she's invited them. And she says to them, "And in all probability, you will see your brother, and whatever may be his faults or the faults of his wife, when I consider whose son he is, I cannot bear to have you wholly estranged from each other." I was like, yeah, we're just laying it on the table. We do not like them, but they're family.
That's a good one. I like that one. I totally skipped over that one, too.
What else have you got while I try to find my other ones?
Let's see. So I have, "As it was impossible, however, now to prevent their coming, Lady Middleton resigned herself to the idea of it with all the philosophy of a well-bred woman, contenting herself with merely giving her husband a gentle reprimand on the subject 5 or 6 times a day."
It's like one of those bad jokes about nagging wives.
It is exactly that, but I still laughed. Have you found your list of good Austen burns?
Apparently, I just like mixed them all in with everything.
Oh, yeah, I have a good sister burn. "Marianne was silent. It was impossible for her to say what she did not feel, however trivial the occasion. And upon Eleanor, therefore, the whole task of telling lies, when politeness required it, always fell." So she's basically saying Marianne can't talk because when she will talk, she'll say exactly what she feels. So when they're in a situation where politeness is necessary, it has to fall to Eleanor.
Oh, I found one. Hold on. It's not so much a burn, but it made me laugh. When Lucy says, "But will you not give me your advice, Mrs. Dashwood?" "No," answered Eleanor, with a smile, which concealed very agitated feelings.
Oh, that's a good one. All right. Now I'll give you my... So this is my nomination for the greatest burn in these chapters. Ready?
Okay.
"I confess," replied Eleanor, "that while I am at Barton Park, I never think of tame and quiet children with any abhorrence."
I think I do remember noting that one.
Oh, it's my favorite. It's such a good burn. So that's my nomination. So, dear listeners, please, if you have any nominations or you'd like to vote between mine and Annie's and vote for mine, then feel free.
One thing I wanted to point out, because I thought it was quite funny. Last weekend, a friend of mine and I went to Wilmington, Delaware to the Winter Tour Estate or Winter Tour Museum, which is on the Winter Tour Estate, once owned by the DuPont family. It got converted into this beautiful like garden museum. And in one of the buildings, they had an exhibit of a lot of wardrobe from the first two seasons of Netflix's The Crown, which was a fantastic, beautiful, amazing, wonderful, glorious exhibit to get lost in for a bit. But the building that they had stored it in, they referred to as the cottage. This building had like giant like marble pillars. It had probably like 50 bedrooms or something. It just made me laugh to think, oh, this is what people call a cottage in a certain time period. It's not like plain one room which I think it's more, it's portrayed as more of a tiny, humble existence in the film version, the 1993 film version. But I think it was a really stark reminder that when people say cottage beyond a certain time period in the past, it's actually quite a nice affair. And it is an establishment that's meant to not just house the family, but also the servants who we generally aren't supposed to see. So I thought that was really interesting to point out.
Oh, that is. I had no idea. That's really cool.
Especially in New England, a cottage is a very, it's an understatement of a word.
So good to know. So it sounds like the Dashwoods aren't exactly destitute.
No, although we discussed in the past just how much money that they have.
The Barton College might not be that tiny.
No, I'm going to say they're somewhat comfortable, though maybe not too comfortable.
Got it. Good way of phrasing it.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I think, you know, a lot of things happened here, but it was a kind of mostly set up. Because now some of the, we know kind of the chess pieces, what chess pieces are on the board. And I'm pretty curious to see what happens to them in London.
Me too. Like, I wonder if we're going to see Lucy at any point. It is kind of disappointing that we get introduced to a lot of other women, especially other women in similar situations as Eleanor and Marianne. And they can't exactly be friends.
Yeah.
So I would like to see how that's going to play out.
I really liked what you said about, you know, there being kind of mirror images of the sisters that we've met. So we can't really help but compare them because I think they're meant to be compared.
I do think so. It might, like, in another universe, I could easily see a book about the Steels being written with Lucy as our plucky hero who falls in love and has some obstacles between her and marrying the man she loves.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I can handle that right now.
Maybe somewhere out there someone has the idea.
Maybe somewhere. All right. Well, I think if that's all we have, then we should adjourn and prepare for next time when we'll cover chapters 26 through 30. We're in the end game now.
We are. Everything's going to start. Shit's going to go down.
Clearly.
We would love to hear from you guys, so please reach out to us. We'd like to hear what you've been thinking about the book so far and what kind of things you're looking forward to.
Your best Jane Austen burn.
Please send them our way. Let us know if we mentioned any of your favorites. And if you do, in fact, know if there is a book out there that covers the Steel story, I would love to know that. You can reach out to us at thedailynightly.com. We have a Goodreads group that one day we will actually put to use. You can find us on Twitter sometimes at nightlypod, but you can also reach out to us on Instagram at thedailynightly, or you could email us directly at thedailynightly@gmail.com. The music is by Kevin MacLeod, which you can find at incompetech.com. Thank you very much for that. Jesse, special thanks to you for existing.
Oh, Annie, right back at ya.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking to you next time about chapters 26 through 30.
Sounds good. Everybody, happy reading.
Happy reading.